Dream of a Formula One race around the streets of London. Downing Street says it's planning legislation to give all local councils the power to stage motor races on public roads, opening the door to a possible Grand Prix in the capital. Luis Suarez has asked Liverpool fans to understand the reasons for his move to Barcelona. The striker will join the Spanish giants on a five-year contract for a fee thought to be in the region of £75 million. These Liverpool supporters outside Anfield say they're not happy with the deal the club owners have struck.
I can't see what's wrong with these Americans letting him go 75 or whatever it is he's going for.
Suarez is the best player in the world and we should never let him go.
He wants to go anyway, so, but 75 million, I think it's not enough.
As many as 800,000 people with type 2 diabetes could be offered weight loss surgery on the NHS. New draft guidance from NICE, the body that advises the government on healthcare, is suggesting lowering the requirements for patients to be considered for surgery. And an earthquake has struck Jersey and Guernsey, the biggest to hit the islands for 90 years. It had a magnitude of 4.2 and shook windows. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
bcfm.org.uk.
Your difference is our strength on Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. It's councillor for Henbury and leader of the Tory group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, well, it's fallen off the headlines, but what's been going on over in Ukraine? I'm joined by Giles Shorter and Patrick McNally from Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity Group. Plus, more horrific bloodshed in Palestine, and as more anti-terror laws in this country are on the cards, what really happened on 7/7? We have a look back at 7/7, 9 years on. Plus, we ask for the third week of trying. Sorry, last couple of weeks have managed to miss this one, but we're going to do it this week. How evil is North Korea, really? And have they got a point when they criticise the West? Plus, Martin's chance to take us on a tour of some of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 23 degrees Celsius, sunny spells, and tomorrow and Sunday. Next week, highs of 27 Celsius, warming up and getting sunnier as the week progresses. 19th and 20th July, that's next weekend, highs of 21 degrees Celsius and sunny spells. Doesn't look like there's going to be any rain at all. But it is certainly humid out there. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me, it's Mark Weston this week to help me go through the news with Mark is the newly elected leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Tell us, how does that process work? Do you have a re-election every year to see, or does someone trigger an election?
No, every group has an AGM. The groups call for nominations for leader. In this case, Peter Abrahams, who was the former leader, stepped down. I put my name forward and I was voted in by the group.
Tell us what your portfolio is on the council, what committees you're on.
As leader of the Conservative group, there are various other briefings and things like that you go on, but I am principally now on resources, so where the money is.
Yeah. Money. Where the money's coming from, where it's going to.
Exactly. Big question.
So answer that question. Yeah, tell us.
Where's the money going to? There's a whole raft of things that the money goes to. I mean, the one that we're going to be discussing in council in 2 weeks' time, for example, we'll be looking at things like the cycling manifesto. The cycling strategy was announced this week. There are things like my beloved Henbury Loop in the north of the city. There's council housing investment. There's a whole range of things. But it's principally looking at the money, how the budget's going to work, and what the change programme is doing.
Now, we had Gary Hopkins, who's taken over...
I'm sure that was a delight.
..the leadership of the Lib Dems last week, and he was pretty critical of the other parties, as you'd expect, saying that actually what's happening is that the other parties are too in bed with the mayor. What's your thoughts about how things are going with the mayor running the city? Because really, ultimately, he's got his 4 years or his 5 years of dictatorship. He can do what he wants.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, the main check on the mayor is actually comes down to the budget, because the council can or cannot pass his budget. We decide how that works. In addition, the mayor needs to form a cabinet, which means that he needs to have at least three councillors in his cabinet. So our relationship with the mayor is the critical friend. I mean, I think Gary's possibly complaining because I think the Lib Dems are getting that relationship wrong. Possibly some gripe because I think obviously Mayor Ferguson was formerly a Lib Dem member until the summer before he was elected. But look, George was elected. He was put in office by the people in the city. He now has a mandate that runs through to May 2016. And if he's not done a good job, we all get to vote him out. Now, I didn't vote for him, but while he's in place, my view is that I will work with him where we agree. And I will publicly disagree with him where we don't.
Well, where do you stand on this story last week? Well, it's one of these kind of farcical stories where the mayor is asking people, there's a picture of him in the Bristol Post with a pair of shears, to go around cutting the grass and the verges and then the parks. I mean, that's what we pay our council tax for.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that. I mean, I like the idea of getting park groups involved in the maintenance of their park.
But the point being, the lawyers, the council lawyers, have looked down the budget. They've gone with the mayor and his advisors, gone through the budget and said, well, legally, we can get away with not doing this. Legally, we can get away with not doing this.
And that's one of those things. You have statutory services and you have non-statutory services.
So are we going to end up with basically paying our council tax for a lot of things not to be done and only the things that the council's going to get sued for doing or not doing? Those are the ones that won't
We're going through the detail on what he's talking about now. I mean, a lot of it wasn't just cutting the grass, it was about having organised litter picks. Now, that happens already in the green spaces in my patch. It's volunteers getting on. I think what we need to find out, George is talking about having a minimum standard. What is that minimum standard? What does it cover? Can volunteers play a constructive role in this? Now, at the Neighbourhood Partnerships, and I've got mine next Monday, we're looking at how we influence those green space budgets and what that future maintenance is going to look like. So at the moment, we don't have the detail.
So is this the big society taking over because the council hasn't got enough money to do what it's supposed to do?
Well, the big society, pardon me saying that, the big society has been there for a long time. There are volunteers acting throughout the city in a whole variety of different ways. Now, there are already park groups, and there have been in my patch for years, some of them for decades. If some of them want to get involved in the running and the maintenance, well, that's fine, but what we need to find out is what the minimum standard is. And are they expecting us to do more in order to better the park? Well, let's have a look at it. But at the moment, we don't have the detail.
Another thing Gary was complaining about was the lack of proper scrutiny. He was saying quite a lot of the committees that he's on, they're supposed to be scrutinising things, but when they're asking questions to the mayor, they're just asking them to an empty chair.
No, I disagree with Gary on that one. We get answers back. They may not be the answers Gary wants to hear, but we do get them back.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the news this week. And it was on the national news earlier on. The suspended Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Nick Gargan is now facing a criminal inquiry. This is in today's paper. I guess it will be in the weekend edition of the Post. Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Nick Gargan is now at the centre of a criminal investigation. It was announced today. Mr Gargan had been suspended from work after he was accused of making inappropriate advances to junior female members of staff at the force. As a result of the ongoing investigation, more allegations have emerged. The Chief Constable passed on sensitive information to people outside the force. A statement on the latest developments was released by the IPCC, Independent Police Complaints Commission, saying that he has been suspended. The IPCC Deputy Chair, Rachel... Oh, crikey, how do you pronounce that? Kerfontaine, said, as part of our investigation, the IPCC has uncovered evidence that the Chief Constable may have breached the Data Protection Act by sending emails concerning police business, some of which contained personal data to individuals unconnected with the force. What do you make of this, Mark? Because he's come in as a new broom. We've got Sue Mount Stevens, the Independent Police and Crime Commissioner. She's appeared on the scene as well over the last couple of years, and the idea was that this was going to be a new broom. Now, it doesn't look as if Nick is going to be around much longer by the look of it. I mean, there's several accusations against him now, and although it doesn't seem that yet anything's been proved, it's looking less and less likely that he's going to be able to continue as Chief Constable.
Look, I'm not one of those that's a fan of the whole smoke without fire issue, so I'm afraid I'm simply not going to comment. If he has done this and it can be proven, then yes, he is going to lose his job. But at the moment, as you said, there are allegations, but there's not been proof. So he's suspended pending that investigation. I think we wait to see what investigation comes. He's innocent until proven guilty.
Martin, this is an interesting one, isn't it? Because when he was initially suspended, there were two accusations against him, apparently. One from a woman who he had allegedly behaved inappropriately, and one from somebody who knew somebody else who she believed, or he believed, we're not told what sex the second accuser was. And now things have shifted. I mean, we've heard about 2 weeks ago, big story in the National Daily Mail about Nick Gargan being removed from the Princess Diana inquiry back in the 1990s, which is really, you would think, has not necessarily got anything to do with what's happening today. Now it's shifted again onto this whole thing of he sent an inappropriate email, or possibly inappropriate emails that they're saying could be breaching data protection laws. So it does seem as if something a little bit peculiar is going on here. So it starts on one accusation, and it moves to another and another and another. And it's almost as if even if the first accusation is definitely proved not to be true, then they're going to get him on something else. Well, what are your thoughts, anyhow?
Well, I have to echo what Mark's just said. This is all being investigated, so it's very difficult for her to take a strong position on the actual case as presented. I do think there is a wider issue about police commissioners. Because we've been seeing in the press this week about unions not having sufficient mandates in strike ballots and so on. And in actual fact, the mandate of these police commissioners is very weak.
Well, what about the mandate for the mayor? That's not exactly
great
either.
Also weak.
This is the actual... What we're talking about here is the proportion of people eligible to vote that actually came and turned out and voted for the police and crime commissioner, for the mayor, etc. What are your thoughts on that, Mark?
Democracy is, I'm afraid, democracy is the right... You have the right to cast a vote, but you also have the right not to cast a vote. Elections are won by those that take part. I think we need to look at trying to, as much as possible, the political parties and independents to engage with the electorate and talk about the issues they care about and reflect their opinions. But ultimately, elections are won by those that take part.
But isn't there a case that says if less than 50% of the people are turning up to vote, then that election needs to be rerun and new candidates found?
You could end up rerunning them, you know, ad infinitum.
Because half the people are expressing no interest, aren't they?
But the alternative is you go down the Australian model where you make voting compulsory. Now, we could do that, but I shy away from that for the simple reason that I think that in a democracy you have the fundamental right to vote, but you don't have to actually have to exercise that. That is a free choice.
Isn't the fact, though, Martin, quite often it's the poorer end of society that don't vote?
Well, it is, and that's a sociological fact which we could wrangle over. But I mean, I'd be interested to hear Mark's view on the Prime Minister saying that trade unions should have at least 50% participating in a ballot, because they're going to put that in the Conservative manifesto next time. Why have unions got to reach a level of so-called democratic participation that, say, shareholder meetings don't meet, local elections don't meet? I think there's only one MP, Tim Farron, who's actually received over 50% of the vote in his constituency. Why have unions got to... And also, on a second point, is I think there are certain things like referendums on whether to have a mayor or not, or whether for Scotland to be independent or not, when you say it does have to be 50%. If there isn't a 50% turnout in Scotland, the vote will be invalid for sure.
So,
right,
yeah.
Okay.
Can you answer that?
Question?
Just a direct question there.
You've got two. So I'll start with the devolution question on Scotland, yeah, and I'll move on to the unions. Again, I go back to what I said earlier. I mean, if you look, remember the Welsh devolution powers when that was happening, I think it was just less than 50% voted, and it was just over 50% of those that voted mm-hmm. for devolution, mm-hmm. and yet it still went through. And now, people have the right to vote. If they don't exercise it, that is entirely their choice. But I'm in the camp that says, if you don't vote, you can't complain. you had a chance to make a statement. Even if you went to the ballot box, even if you spoil your ballot paper, that is actually exercising your right. But not doing it, I'm afraid that's apathy. And that is a problem for the parties, but it's also a problem for the individual as well. But when it comes to the unions, yes, I actually agree with the Prime Minister. I think unions do have a minimum. And the reason is, when you hold a democratic election for councillors, for the mayor, you're asking everyone that's going to be affected by that election to cast a vote. The unions will affect a much wider remit of society, and yet only they get to vote on it. So I actually agree with the threshold. I think it's right.
Well, I'll just say that's blatantly inconsistent is what I would suggest, is what I would say.
Why? How?
Because he's just made the case that those who participate... I'm actually in favour of the Australian solution of making people vote. That's
but why is it inconsistent? Answer
no, because he's suggesting that when people don't vote in local elections or national elections or referendums on independence in Scotland or Wales or devolution, that's fine because they've chosen not to exercise their votes. Lots of people are very passive in trade unions. That doesn't mean they don't necessarily, they just can't be bothered. One of the things that the trade union leadership have been saying, what we need to do is have workplace ballots, right? So because actually it's all done by post at the moment,
I think they used to do
they used to have show of hands and all the rest of it at the factory gates and all the rest of it. And you, of course, the argument in favour of that is you want to see who's on what side
and which way they're voting, but there were
allegations about that as well. No, when you hold an election for a politician, for a political party, everyone who is affected by that, so everyone in my ward gets to vote for me or doesn't get to vote for me. The unions, for example, the teaching unions, that their vote, how they vote, will impact people not in the union, I think should have a minimum threshold to show what that is, because they're affecting people far beyond just in their remit.
Well, people voted for Tony Blair, didn't they? And he affected a few people in Iraq. And they weren't given a chance
and
to
maybe
vote.
Maybe we should argue about whether he should have done or not.
Anyway, on to one of the big stories of the week. And we're going to hear now from Sir Norman Tebbit, who spoke out at the weekend about his thoughts about the possibility of a paedophile ring existing connected with Westminster back in the 1980s. Sir Norman Tebbit.
Most people would have thought that the establishment, the system, was to be protected. And if a few things had gone wrong here and there, that it was more important to protect the system than to delve too far into them. Now, that view, I think, was wrong then, and it is spectacularly shown to have been wrong because the abuses have grown. It was almost unconscious. It was the thing that people did. At that time, you didn't talk about those sort of things.
Well, that's not very good, is it? If you're a politician, you don't talk about those sort of things. Mark, what are your thoughts about Norman Tebbit's statement at the weekend? Because I think it was quite interesting. It was almost as if we weren't sure what was going to happen, but Norman stepped out and he said, actually, there is a problem here. We really do need to deal with this, didn't he?
I hope he's wrong, but I fear he is right. And I think it needs to be thoroughly investigated. You need to get to the bottom of it. And if through incompetence, conspiracy, for whatever the reason, people have allowed these crimes, and they are appalling. I'm at the point now where I'm sick of reading them because it makes me physically sick. If they've been allowed to carry on because people turned a blind eye, then to my mind, the people that walked away from it are almost as guilty as those that carried it out.
I'd like to mention for the umpteenth time on this show the Kinkora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, which was the subject of Ken Livingstone's maiden speech when he was first elected to Parliament. The Kinkora Boys' Home was used as a honey trap by MI5 to capture mainly loyalist paramilitary leaders who were lured in there to have sex with underage boys, being photographed and then subsequently blackmailed by MI5. I don't suppose anybody in MI5 has been punished for any of that, and that's how our country is run.
Well, how do you mean? You can't run a country like that, surely, Martin?
The intelligence services all over the world have always had a very strong interest in paedophilia as a means of blackmail of others. And when politicians are paedophiles, that makes it very easy to blackmail them.
If you pardon me saying this, this is an incredibly serious issue. You're you're making allegations and it's conspiracy theories and all the rest of it. Now, my fear is if we start to trot out conspiracy theories like that, a lot of people then start to shut their eyes and shut their ears by saying, oh, you've taken it to an extreme, therefore the argument's just got absurd. This is serious. I don't know anything about the MI5 situation. I'm not about to start accusing governments of using paedophilia as a way to honey trap politicians. Let's get this thoroughly investigated and let's find out without resorting to conspiracies.
Well, it may be if it's properly investigated, we'll find out that there was a conspiracy.
Then it may be. But as we said earlier when we talked about Nick Gargan, you know, when we were talking about him, you're innocent and proven guilty. But what I want to know is I want to know how far this went up the tree, who turned a blind eye, if anyone turned a blind eye, and what level of incompetence or conspiracy resulted in this happening. But let's get the facts out before we start jumping to conclusions.
One fact is that for one of the reasons a lot of this hasn't come out in the past is because many of the newspapers, the media in this country are very worried, nervous about being sued for libel. And so this is one of the reasons why it took so long for the Jimmy Savile case to come out, for example, because while he was alive he could sue them for libel, after he was dead he couldn't. Anyway, one of the...
You are innocent till proven guilty. That's the fundamental... Believe,
but then there
it?
Also should be some kind of beefing up of freedom of speech, in my view, you know, to make sure that accusations can be made.
Yeah, but you can't just simply accuse someone of being a paedophile.
If they're true, this is the point. If they turn out to be true, then you should be looked after, because there was this chap, Simon Regan, who used to work for The Sun, and he was a journalist in London, sort of private eye style magazine he did called Scallywag in the 1990s. He printed some allegations about a similar sort of ring, and he was sued and closed down. Now, the allegations he printed in his magazine, he was sued for, were actually that John Major was having an affair with Edwina Curry. He was closed down for that story, and then it later emerged to be true. This is a problem, is this. But the legal system isn't working, and if you can't afford to take someone to the legal system, there's a serious problem.
Before you make an accusation, particularly something about calling someone a paedophile, you have to have evidence to do it. I mean, you had the whole Sally Berko Twitter mistakes and all the rest of it, where people were branding someone completely innocent, we assume, completely innocent, as a paedophile, when there was absolutely no evidence, and in the end the person who had incorrectly named him, I think quite innocently incorrectly named him, said, no, it's not him. But being called a paedophile is just about the worst thing I think you can call someone. And there are people out there that will say no smoke without fire, and that mud sticks and all the rest of it, and I think you have to be absolutely sure of your evidence before you do so.
Okay, well, one person it certainly was proved that was abusing children was Cyril Smith, of course, after he's dead and can't sue for libel.
Nope.
And one of the people that investigated that case was Detective Sergeant Jack Tasker. He interviewed Cyril Smith and also had quite a lot of files on that case and some of his alleged victims. But in the middle of his case, we heard on the Victoria Derbyshire show earlier this week, he was visited by two senior police, and we're going to hear now from Detective Sergeant Jack Tasker.
They said they wanted every scrap of paper that I referred to Cyril Smith's inquiry, every statement, every little note we'd made, everything that we had about him had to go on that desk, and there would be serious consequences if it didn't. I didn't inquire on the serious consequences.
What did you think that meant?
Well, I thought it meant that I'd be in serious trouble, and so would Tom. Everything was put on the table. We were instructed that we must not do anything at all, interview anyone at all concerned with Cyril Smith, speak to anyone about Cyril Smith, do anything at all about Cyril Smith, and there would be serious consequences if we did. They then took everything they had, went away. They said they were taking the over inquiry. We never heard anything at all about the inquiry thereafter, and as far as I was concerned, it died.
Well, I mean, we know in this case that Cyril Smith was guilty, but as you pointed out, this didn't come out at the time. I think there's a general sense in the society generally that those who are powerful, well connected, that their crimes, whether paedophilia or other crimes, are covered up, and I think that's the real danger for our democracy, is that people basically start to feel that the establishment always closes ranks. These things are always covered up and nothing is ever properly investigated.
Mark, what do you think were thoughts there about the evidence presented by that detective sergeant? That he's saying basically he's on the road to investigating serious child abuse allegations against a very important person, and he finds that the higher ups in the police turn up, take all of the evidence, say they're taking over the inquiry, and that's the end of it.
Well, at this point, it does start to look like it's a conspiracy and the cover-up, doesn't it? This is one of the things that I think has to be investigated, because actually I do echo, probably for the first time, what Martin was saying, that, you know, people need to have faith in the system. And if the system is there, if the system's entire purpose is simply to prolong its own power, then it's missed the entire reason why it's there. In democracy, you're meant to serve the people, and you're not meant to just serve your own ambition and try and cover up any abuses that you've done. And everything should be investigated in this independent inquiry. And I think those that think this is going to be quick and it's going to take just a few months or anything else, no, this has to go right to the root, and I think we're in for a long Leveson-like investigation.
Well, the civil servant, one civil servant is being brought in for this new inquiry. The NSPCC boss, the current NSPCC boss, is a long-time senior civil servant, personal private secretary to three cabinet ministers. One of the worrying things is that Trevor Kavanagh, the editor of one of the Murdoch newspapers, who used to be work in the parliamentary lobby at Westminster as a journalist, he had some very interesting things to say. From a journalist's point of view, as someone that had worked during the 1980s in Westminster, and he spoke specifically about Sir Peter Hayman, who was a very senior civil servant at the time.
Well, Sir Peter Hayman was a Whitehall mandarin, hugely respected, hugely decorated, and he was the man who was operating under the name of Peter Henderson, and was having obscene material related to paedophilia sent to an address in London, which he had set up. And his name was exposed by Geoffrey Dickens in the Commons after attempts were made to conceal his role when trials of paedophiles took place at the time. You've got a Freemasonry operating in the police service and in Westminster. I think that this is probably the tip of a very large iceberg. When you have an organization like the Paedophile Information Exchange, legitimized by the fact that its officers can actually open an office inside the Home Office and keep its files and print its documents, you have to wonder how on earth it could possibly have existed without people knowing and accepting its existence and knowing exactly what it was doing.
Martin, another revelation a few weeks ago, maybe a month and a half ago, about the Paedophile Information Exchange was actually that it was largely a government-funded organisation. The government put the money up for it to get started in the first place. We heard there, too, that they had offices within the Home Office itself.
Yes, well, I mean, if you think about the De True case in Belgium some years ago, so a couple of decades ago now, he was a very protected paedophile because he was part of a paedophile ring which involved senior politicians and people at the top. And I think this is there is what you might call the paedophile issue, and then there's another issue here, which is power plays around paedophilia. If you can get various politicians compromised or senior civil servants compromised, then some people are able to obtain political favours or obtain, you know, create a political agenda around that. I mean, obviously we don't know what happened in these cases, but I think that we suspect that this is not just random paedophiles, that there is actually rings of paedophiles who are probably well known to the security services at the time. What were the security services doing? Now there's a question.
Mark, I don't know what if you want to respond to that. You're quite welcome to the to Trevor Kavanagh there talking about this senior civil servant who was involved in this and the paedophile information exchange. But then there's also Theresa May's announcement this week about these two inquiries.
Okay, well, you've got two issues. I mean, the first one about the civil servant, again, that forms part of the investigation. And I actually think Martin's probably right. By the sound of it, there is a ring of paedophiles. I don't know how far the security services are involved in this, or whatever. That needs to be investigated. But it is appalling, and it does leave you slightly at a loss for words, which is a rare one for me. I actually don't have... I think May's appointment of the NSPCC chief is a good thing, because I think you need to have a specialist knowledge if you're going into this. You have to have a certain sensitivity and understanding of the conditions, because this kind of investigation is going to be harrowing for anyone involved in it. They're going to hear details and they're going to hear events that will give me nightmares. This is going to be appalling. And I think appointing someone that senior with that kind of knowledge, I think she's made the right decision.
But the thing is,
but there are caveats on it, I know.
With Hillsborough, for example, we had an inquiry after inquiry done by officials, by civil servants, by the police. Yeah. The only one that really has seemed to have been satisfactory from the family's point of view is one that was actually led by people completely independent of government up in Liverpool. And that was only pushed for because of the strength of the people on Merseyside to do that.
Yeah. I mean, everything has to start somewhere. Okay. I think this investigation, I don't think it'll be the definitive. I think allegations and information is going to continue to come out for years to come. Because it might not be one ring. There could be several. And they might have been totally independent from each other, working in the dark and sordid places in people's minds. But this is a place to start. We have to start asking questions. We have to start getting answers.
But I take what you say about this being really dark stuff. A lot of people don't want to go there. And isn't that maybe, Martin, one of the reasons that they've got away with it for so long? Because it's very difficult to find people with the backbone to really take these issues on. I mean, we heard a little bit about the Peter Heyman there. Mm. We also hear, he was the deputy director of MI6. This is the civil servant who had different names and ordering up paedophile material.
Yes, well, I suggest that there is a contiguousness between the intelligence services and paedophilia. Homosexuality is no longer a blackmailable offence. You know, most people, if it came out that they were married and were having a homosexual affair, that wouldn't end their political career in modern Britain. But paedophilia remains, as it should remain, a very, very serious offence. And therefore, of course, it does necessarily lead to situations where blackmail is possible. And it may be that the intelligence services have been using paedophilia as a means of blackmail. They certainly did in the Kinkora boys' home.
Okay, I think you made your point, Martin. Right, another story. Islamist terror threat to the West has been blown out of all proportion, said the former MI6 chief. Richard Dearlove says extremists are now focused on the Middle East. Giving them publicity in the West is counterproductive. Richard Dearlove said Britain's spreading blood-curdling terrorism messages should be ignored. Mark, what do you think?
I think that is the voice of a man that no longer has a stake in it. I think if he gets it, I think if our security services ignored terror threats, however hysterical those threats may be, and one of them turned out to be genuine, then we would be baying for blood. The terrorists only have to get it right once. We need to get it right every single time. And so I think that we all need to take a serious look at what our security levels are. Yes, they don't need to be disproportionate, but I think there is a threat out there.
Martin, he was talking to the Royal United Services Institute, London-based security and defence think tank. He said the conflict was essentially one of Muslim on Muslim. He made it clear he believed the way the British government and the media were giving extremists the oxygen of publicity was counterproductive. Media are making monsters of misguided young men, rather pathetic figures, who are getting coverage more than their wildest dreams, said Dearlove, adding, it's surely better to ignore them.
Well, this is the question is, what is MI6? And I would suggest that what we really need is a police investigation of every terrorist offence that takes place, or potential offence. That's why, for example, the Police Service of Northern Ireland was set up, because the Royal Ulster Constabulary had to be disbanded, and the Police Service of Northern Ireland, of course, is independent of MI5 and MI6. Now, the Ghouta chemical weapons attack this time last year, Seymour Hirsch, who's a very senior investigative journalist in the US, wrote a very interesting article in the London Review of Books, The Red Lines and the Rat Lines, which pointed the finger firmly at the Turkish intelligence services working with Saudis to take Libyan chemical weapons material into Syria to carry out that attack. Now, who works closely with the Turks and the Saudis? Oh, that would be MI6. Now, that's why I would like to see the police service of Northern Ireland investigate MI6, because this time last year, let's remind everybody listening, we were about to bomb Syria back into the Stone Age because they'd carried out the attack. Not only did they not carry out the attack, it was Western allies that carried out the attack. It was a NATO-based attack.
Allegedly,
and that's why we need a police investigation, because MI6 and the CIA in the Gladio networks, which were set up in the 1940s, according to police investigations in Italy, including the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Imposimato, who wrote a book about this last year, there is no doubt in his mind, as head of the Italian Supreme Court, that MI6 and CIA were involved in the bombing of Bologna railway station, for example, which killed 86 people and like the 50 so odd killed on 7-7. The problem is, out there in the world beyond the bubble of the Western media, lots of people do believe that the CIA and MI6 engage in terrorism. And you know what? They're not wrong. They do. And that's why we need a police investigation.
Can we get back to this, though, Martin? Because what he's saying is that actually there seems to be an attempt to take what he calls here pathetic figures and blow them up out as bogeymen out of all proportion.
Well, they are what is known in the technical terms as patsies. So, in other words, what happens when you've got a terrorist attack which has actually worked from within inside the security structure is you've got patsies who get the blame and then other people who actually carry out the attack. And, of course, the real perpetrators are inside the security structure.
So are you saying these people aren't attacking anyone?
No, I'm not saying they're not. I mean, the fact of the matter is that Haroun Aswat, who was named by the Metropolitan Police Investigation as the mastermind on 7-7, because he'd been on the phone to all four bombers the week before, he was named as an MI6 double agent by John Loftus from the United States and is now being held in Broadmoor, incommunicado, where no police officer can speak to him. Now, what we've got to actually do is get the police to investigate terrorism thoroughly and certainly to put on the possibilities that they're investigating that it's from within the security structure.
Okay.
People in Ireland know what I'm talking about. People in Italy know what I'm talking about.
If you pardon me saying this, Martin, you're sounding a little hysterical on this one. I understand the passion you're talking about, but I think you're taking the argument to such an extreme that it starts to shut down the argument because people start to ignore it. There is a security threat out there. We need to look at the level that it is. I think that the comments made, because we did veer away from the story, comments made by the former MI6 chief were made to make his point by a person that no longer had a stake in tackling terrorism. I think the current security services do an excellent job. Sometimes they go too far, I would agree with you, but I think they do an excellent job at keeping most of us safe.
I, for one,
sleep soundly knowing that they're working.
Most of us agree that the banking fraternity are a little bit dodgy, to say the least. I mean, we've had all these various...
Terrorism to banking, interesting. Well, I know,
and I'm going to make that connection, believe it or not, because we've had the LIBOR scandal, we've had money laundering,
we've had
PPI, we've had interest rate swaps, we've now had foreign exchange. And what they keep calling mis-selling actually is fraud. People should be going to jail for this, and they're not. But, if you ever read Spycatcher, as I did, back in probably the early 90s, I think I read it, what they're doing there is they're pinning, for example, Victor Rothschild, pinning them very, very close to the security services. He was the person who was recommending who was going to take over at MI6 and MI5, according to Peter Wright, who was an insider, and that there seemed to be a very, very close connection between what I would call the banksters, that is to say, the people that still haven't been arrested, that may be arrested in the future, and the security services. And Martin, I think, you know, you probably have had a look quite a lot at how money laundering and how big drug deals around the world connect the banking fraternity and the security state.
Listen, I may sound hysterical, but it's very straightforward. There is historical evidence, overwhelming historical evidence, that groups like the CIA and MI6 is almost like a subsection of the CIA have definitely been involved in terrorism in recent decades. The Iran-Contra affair was exposed by a congressional inquiry in the United States. It was quite clear what was going on. Large amounts of drugs were being brought into the United States. The money was being recycled to the Contras, who were using it to carry out terrorist attacks inside Nicaragua against the democratically elected government of Nicaragua. And Colonel Oliver North, who was at the centre of all of that, has not been punished or prosecuted, even though it's absolutely clear that's what was going on.
He was pardoned, I think.
He was pardoned, indeed. Now, that means that the MI6 as a subsection of the CIA, it's effectively what it is. The CIA does in fact engage in drug dealing and terrorism, and it's no, there's no point to any police officer. The Italian police force have been dealing with this for years. Imposimato is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, and he was an investigating magistrate in the Bologna bombing, for example. So he's not speaking as a journalist, as you or I might do. He's got the basis of decades of investigation by the civil police force. Now, if we want to get to the bottom of terrorism, Islamic terrorism, fascist terrorism, even left-wing terrorism like the Red Brigades, you have to actually have independent police officers who are prepared to investigate the intelligence services. Not because the intelligence services always carry these things out, but sometimes they definitely do.
And investigative journalists, Mark.
Not sure where to go on that. MI6 is not a subsection of the CIA. Yes, I would imagine they work together quite closely on some issues, and I imagine they oppose each other on others. So I don't think you can make the broad generalisation that you've done. I'm not also sure of the link between the banking and terrorism. I've no doubt that some banks do dodgy stuff in relation to terrorism. In relation to terrorism. And where that has happened, it's quite easy. They go to jail. Someone, at some point, goes to jail. What annoys me about the banking crisis is the fact that no one has gone to jail. Now, I'm very sorry. If you make such a catastrophic, and you know you're making a catastrophic mistake, then you go to prison. And it is because they were running around with total impartiality and they were making mistakes. Now, I'm not one that's going to demonise bankers because I think they play an important role. And I think sometimes when we demonise banks, we forget the little people, shall we say, that work at the local branch and they do good work. But someone at the top, when they make these kind of mistakes, knew what was going wrong, and they should be prosecuted.
But isn't the trouble the fact that they haven't been prosecuted, they get kudos from it? It's like, wow, I'm the naughty boy and I got away with it.
This feeds into the cycle that sort of we were coming to earlier when we were talking about the establishment. No one is above the law. No one should be above the law. And if anyone breaks the law, they go to jail.
Well, that's the
or
theory.
Pay the fine. That's the theory.
That's the theory. Anyway,
that's
game,
the way it should
just,
work.
I just wanted to reiterate, this is just something that, you know, is in Spycatcher. Peter Wright does say that Victor Rothschild, one of the heads of the one of the biggest banking fraternities in the world, was actually he's dead. He's dead. So you can't do me for libel now. But Victor Rothschild was making all the key recommendations and you know, to Margaret Thatcher about who was going to take over which security service. Anyway, back to another story, sort of developed on from that this week. Which is David Cameron's new emergency law, called the DRIP law.
They need to come up with a catchier title.
How they've managed that. Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Law, which apparently is going to go through Parliament on Monday, an emergency debate. I first saw it in a tweet by Tom Watson, I think, on Wednesday, when he'd noticed that parliamentary schedules had been shifted around and maybe got a few tip-offs from some civil servants or something. But he actually announced it before the newspapers and 24 hours or so before Parliament. Now, before we just hear the clip from Cameron talking about DRIP, what are your thoughts about the idea of sending this to the newspapers 24 hours before MPs are told about it, Mark?
Sorry, I'm not sure who sent it. Was it Tom Watson sent it?
No. This is the Downing Street sent an announcement round the press 24 hours, just under 24 hours before MPs were told about it.
No, I actually think it should have gone to the MPs and the press at the same time.
Yeah, that's the standard procedure, surely.
It should be, I should think. But anyway, maybe they were hoping to get a bit of spin out of some friendly press. Who knows? Anyway, here's David Cameron defending his new DRIP law, and it's followed by, in the Commons, Tom Watson and a representative from the campaign group Liberty about this emergency debate that appears is happening on Monday.
It is used in 95% of all serious organised crime cases handled by the Crown Prosecution Service. It has been used in every major security service counter-terrorism investigation over the past decade. And it's the foundation for prosecutions of paedophiles, drug dealers and fraudsters.
British people aren't stupid and they're not ideological when it comes to this kind of thing. Why can they not have time to discuss it with their elected representatives?
Well, this is really an insult to our democracy. What we have is a stitch-up behind the scenes by the three major parties, which denies the public, denies Parliament, the chance to really scrutinise these proposals.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this? This is coming in an emergency debate on Monday. Quite a lot of MPs seem to be a bit unhappy about the way it's being attempted to be rushed through Parliament, but it's been agreed by the main party leaders already.
Well, I'm not very happy with that. It shouldn't just be agreed like that on the nod. Very, very unsatisfactory. But let's unpick this rationally. What the European Court overturned was the keeping of data for 12 months so that it could be accessed by the security services. That was rushed through Parliament after 7-7. Now, if we go back to Italy in the 70s, the 80s and the 90s, the Strategia di Tensione, which NATO intelligence services were pursuing, involved creating bomb attacks, for example, assassinations of police officers, and then rushing through Parliament emergency legislation, hence the whole concept of the strategy of tension. Now, I'm not saying that that is what's going on here, but I'm just saying it's a perfectly legitimate line of police inquiry to presume that it might be going on. That, in other words, we have a bomb attack which actually is ultimately sourced inside the security structure, which then leads to passing of illiberal measures through Parliament, which otherwise would not have been passed. Now, this is not necessarily the case. I'm just putting it forward as a potential case. It's not a hysterical point. It's a logical point. And we know from historical fact that NATO has in the past engaged in terrorist organisations, the Gladio structures. Anybody can look this up by going to a computer and typing in Gladio.
The thing that bothers me about this, Mark, is that it looks as if what's been going on over the past few years has actually been illegal. The European Court, that's what they're hinting, and what David Cameron and the Conservatives mainly, it seems, are trying to do here is to bring what they're doing.
Don't bring the politics into it, because Ed Miliband and every other major party signed up on it.
Okay. What they seem to be trying to do is to bring those activities now within the law. Well, that's surely not the way things should work. They should be prosecuted if they've done something wrong.
Well, no, because what it did... the law was tested, and it was ruled out of order in April. Now, we have a situation that, unless this is rushed through, ongoing investigations go dark, and all the information that they're trying to do to make these prosecutions, and the security services try and make us safer, they stop working, because they're no longer going to do it. The DRIP law, and I really wish they had a better acronym for that, the DRIP law itself has a, is it graveyard clause, is that the terminology?
Yeah.
That it expires in 2016. Because we do need to have this fundamental debate and the balancing on what is liberty and what is security and how the two meet. I personally don't have a problem with the DRIP law because of that graveyard clause. Because this buys us time to get it right, as the current investigations, which are using the old legal system, can use the information they've got to make the prosecutions and all the rest of it. If it didn't have the graveyard clause, I'd be very concerned. But we now have the time to have that wider debate on where liberty and where security interact with each other. So I'm okay. I wouldn't say I was comfortable, but I'm okay with it.
Does it not feel to you that this is being bounced through?
Well, no, because the ruling was in April. Now, unless we actually get something through quickly, everything goes dark. We actually only have a narrow
June,
window.
July. Okay, so
but you can't draft
a couple of months.
You can't draft you can't draft a wide-ranging and fully in-depth legislation in any less than that time.
So why weren't MPs like Tom Watson brought on this 2 months ago? It does. I mean, you know, I can see from his point of view, he's saying, well, what on earth did you not talk to me about this for? You know, every MP is going to have an input on this, so, you know, just do it in an open way. It seems like it's been cooked up behind the scenes, doesn't it?
Well, if you pardon me saying this, but legislation is cooked up behind the scenes, and then it goes to Parliament to vote for. I think Tom Watson's being a little selective with the evidence he wants. I think, if you remember, Labour and government did the exact same process. We have legislation. It is far faster than I would be comfortable with, but it is also, it's got a strict timetable, and this will collapse. This will fall in 2016, by which time we will have time to bring something in which is more in depth, more thought through, with the kind of involvement that Tom Watson wants. But if we don't get this through rapidly, then current investigations and police inquiries into terrorism, into paedophiles, all that goes.
Okay, Martin. Jim Killick, who's director of the Open Rights Group, said today that the government's tacitly admitting our current data retention laws are illegal and they're required to re-legislate. The European Court's ruled that data retention should be limited and blanket retention can't be justified because it interferes with our right to privacy. However, Theresa May actually wants to increase the amount of communication data that's kept about us.
if you have a suspicion that somebody is a terrorist, for example, Colonel Oliver North, then you can get a warrant from a judge in the United States or Britain or anywhere else to tap their phone calls and interfere with their communications. If you haven't got suspicion that somebody's a terrorist, you shouldn't have any right to look at their stuff. It's actually in the US Constitution.
Yeah.
It's in the US Constitution that you're not allowed to interfere with stuff unless you've got a warrant. Now, I come back to what I was saying earlier about having the police primacy. The intelligence services have far too much power in the West, far too much power. The Italian police force will agree with me.
Martin, let me just interrupt you, because the point here you've missed, I think, which is that data retention is there for a specific purpose. You can go to your judge and get your warrant, but you can only have that information if the data's been retained.
No, but the point is, if you've got a suspicion about somebody, then you can get your warrant, then you can check their data. You can't just fish everybody's data up and then use that. That's against the law.
I mean, the police and the security services aren't going to sit there and read everything that I put on Facebook, I really hope anyway, because some of it's rather bland.
The computers will do it for them.
Well, no, but they're not going to look at it unless they have a suspicion. Now, if they go to the judge and the judge says, yes, there is a suspicion of, I don't know, Joe Bloggs is a terrorist, then you can then go to the service provider and get all the information and look at it. Until that time, it's just going to sit there dormant. I mean, I think we need to get away from the idea that there's a Gestapo out there that's going to read absolutely every single thing we do. The Gestapo didn't have that power when they were around, and our security services certainly don't have it now. This is about security, plain and simple. Now, it is only the first step in a wider debate on liberty and security, but I think it is an important and I think it's a necessary step.
Well, I think what's happening is you're going to find Tom Watson and David Davis are not going to be happy about this.
I would imagine.
There are libertarians in the Commons who will oppose this, and I would be naturally on their side.
Oh, I have every faith that you would. I mean, I wouldn't call myself comfortable, but I can understand the necessity of having it. Now, though, I mean, it's almost certainly going to go through. When it goes through, we then need to have that wider discussion about how all this is going to work and what the checks are and everything else. But the police simply can't decide to go and look at your Twitter feed and everything else you've tweeted about or Facebooked or messaged or phoned. They can't simply decide to do it. They need to show, and they need to go to a judge, and they need to be able to prove that you have a case to answer. Then they get that data.
That's right, but the police are not the security services. The security services do what they want.
I think Twitter is public, isn't it? I mean,
I don't tweet.
That's not.
I'm a technological Luddite.
What they're talking about here is information about who you've been phoning, building up your social networks of confidential stuff. Anyway, on to another story, and we have a fundamental threat to our freedom of expression, says a lawyer this week in The Guardian. New data handling guidance now under consideration would require reporters to warn public figures at the beginning of an investigation and then destroy their notes and phone numbers afterwards, according to a report in The Times. Media organisations have objected to the guidelines drawn up by the Information Commissioner's Office as a result of moves at the European Union and UK level to introduce greater protection for individual privacy. Now, this is quite interesting, wasn't it, Mark? They're arguing that the requirements would have a chilling effect on journalism.
And I'd agree with them.
Pointing out the public interest journalism is being defined too narrowly in the guidance while offering too great a protection for privacy.
I think irresponsible journalism is bad. I think if you're going to publish something, you need to have evidence. But investigative journalism, the best forms of investigative journalism have to be protected. It is freedom of expression. And tipping off someone that they're the subject of an investigation, it's just absurd.
Well, I don't know if you remember the Cook report from the 1980s and 90s. I mean, if he was to tip off the people that he was stalking, I mean, he was doing basically sting operations on criminals, and then actually many people went down after the investigations that he did on them. It would completely get rid of the point of what he was doing.
There need to be checks on what journalists publish, but they have a right to investigate it, and you certainly shouldn't tip off someone. I mean, what if it was another Cyril Smith style case, you know, and the journalists
landed with a super injunction on your desk
the next
day?
They would just close you down, and we shouldn't have that. We should be a free society.
Well, investigative journalism is actually very difficult to sustain. I talked to an investigative journalist once in a pub in London, And he said, well, of every nine investigations that we carry out, he worked for The Guardian, for every nine investigations that we carry out, only one ever appears in print. And frequently the lawyers say, well, you can't use it, even though we've spent maybe years investigating whatever it is. And sometimes what happens is the police come to us to say, we are investigating these people ourselves and we don't want you to publish anything about it. Please, would you lay off? Because we're still looking into what's going on here.
But that is legitimate, if there's an ongoing investigation.
It's all legitimate, but it's very, very expensive, whereas, of course, hacking Millie Dowler's phone is actually quite cheap and easy to do.
Okay.
Yeah, which, again, it go to irresponsible journalism.
That's irresponsible stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
It's criminal.
Public sector strikes hit schools and services around the UK. That was yesterday. Hundreds of thousands of people took part in rallies and marches around Britain as part of a day of strike action by public service unions. So quite a lot of unions involved in this. Firefighters, PCS, Public and Commercial Services Union, that's mostly civil servants, general municipal boilermakers, amongst others, Unite members, and National Union of Teachers, and the Rail Maritime Transport members, mostly the old public service unions. Now, Mark, this is a great right, free right to strike. Any objections?
Well, I obviously don't support the strike. I think it...
Are you in a union?
No, I'm not. I wouldn't be in a union. Would I really? I mean, come on, you know me.
Well, there are some Tories in unions. Yeah. I mean,
I don't. I mean, actually, we were talking about it earlier, weren't we? When we were talking about the threshold.
But you know, there's 15 times more people in this country in a trade union than there are in a political party, for example. So it's a big constituency out there.
Yeah, no, I accept that, but I'm afraid I don't agree with what they were striking for, and I think it did untold damage.
They're annoyed.
I can understand they're annoyed, but I think it did untold damage to poor people who are actually just trying to go about their daily lives.
The point is that they're living in a country where their income is going less and less far. They're finding that they're basically standing still or even going backwards sometimes in the amount of money that they've got in their pockets. So they're being penalised. That's what they say. And what they're doing is they are public servants.
Yeah, but let's be honest about this. They knew when they went on strike that it wasn't going to have an impact. It wasn't going to do what they wanted to do. All they did was inconvenience absolutely everybody in society. And I have to say, looking at what the figures are, there seems to be some dispute about how effective it was even within themselves. I mean, you look at the civil servant figures, and most schools, vast majority of schools, stayed open. Most civil servants stayed at work. It seems to be in a bit of a damp squib from what the organisers wanted it to be, a day of militancy.
Martin, what's the point of all this then?
Well, it's that people don't likely take a day off work and lose a day's pay, especially the lowest paid. It's basically making, you know, if you don't shout, if you don't fight your corner, you get walked all over. Ultimately, of course, they're not going to be able to pressurise the government. It's actually a struggle over public opinion, really. So if they're taking a day off work, they're protesting about the general drift of government policy. We were talking about the bankers earlier. The top 1% in our society have done very well out of the crisis. They haven't, in fact, lost at all.
Well, let's
they're
say
40%
it's
richer than they were.
It's not a crisis for them.
Well,
it's no,
in,
a
indeed
bit of
it's
a
not. And so, in other words, what's being suggested by the government, I won't say the coalition because the Liberals are not quite sure, is that the public sector is going to have to carry on being squeezed for possibly 5, possibly 10, possibly 15 years to pay off the bankers' debts. Meanwhile, the bankers are laughing all the way to the bank. Ordinary people have a right to fight their corner. And I don't think you're saying that these strikes are illegal, even though you oppose them. People are entitled
no,
to
people
take
are
to
entitled
fight their
strike.
Corner.
I have an issue on the threshold, which you spoke about earlier. But no, I don't. I think the unions actually do serve a good purpose on the whole. I think they are there to protect workers, and I support their right to exist. Of course I do. But I just, when you were talking earlier, you were saying that it's a battle of public opinion, I think it was an own goal yesterday. I don't think it will have done anything to boost their cause. I think they mistimed it, and I think it was utterly ineffective.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest. That was Mark Weston, leader of the Conservative
Group.
I wanted
to say one last thing.
Go on, quickly, very quickly.
Quickly on your debate later. Is North Korea evil? Yes. Thank
you. Okay, thanks. And it's fallen off the headlines this week. But what's been going on in Ukraine?
This
I'm Gary, joined by Bristol Ukraine Anti-Fascist Solidarity. Plus, we have many other stories after the news.
And on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a 16-year-old boy says he accepts responsibility for killing his teacher at a school in Leeds. He'll stand trial accused of murder later this year. Our reporter Mike McCarthy has more.
The boy appeared via a video link from an undisclosed location. He's accused of murder, and although he didn't make a plea today, his barrister said that he'd accepted responsibility for the unlawful killing of teacher Anne Maguire. She died aged 61 on April the 28th this year, after being stabbed by a pupil at Corpus Christi College in Leeds, where she'd worked for more than 40 years.
Palestinian authorities say 100 people have died in Gaza following 4 days of Israeli airstrikes. The Israeli military claims to have hit more than 1,100